Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to another episode of the Chai Lounge podcast. It's been a while since we've been in the studio, but I'm back again with a very special guest, Kanita Hunter.
Where's my chai?
Where's your chai? I thought about it. But you know, in the rush. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the Chai Lounge. It's lovely to have you here.
Wa alaikum salam. Are you a chai, like, are you a snob about it?
Yes and no. So the kicker is that I don't drink chai.
Ah.
Yeah. I don't like milk in tea or coffee. But I can make the best chai you will ever drink.
But if you don't drink it, then I don't trust you.
I'm telling you, going on anecdotes, you need to taste my chai.
And what's the ratio thing that makes it like lacquer?
So my sister will disagree with me, but it's to have whole spices, roast them.
No, man, that's too hard. How are you going to do that on a random Thursday afternoon?
You've got to roast your... I keep it in a little bottle. I roast my spices. Then the milk first, infused with the tea bags. Lastly, water. Lots of brewing.
Because the brewing of the milk first with the tea bag is the trick, I think. Tea bag, water.
Yes, it's milk, spices, milk, tea bag, water. That's my ratios. Okay. It's a good chai.
But I'll do the instant packet too.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not averse to it. I'm not averse to it. But now, recently, I'm brewing my own chai without the milk. Just for like the health. I'm on the millennial health kick.
Okay, so okay. So the whole tea.
With the saffron and the anise seeds. Ah. And yeah, so I'm doing a whole thing. I'm on a whole health kick. At the moment.
You know, they sell them at the shop, the tea bags that you can just...
Yeah, but authenticity. Let's jump into our discussion. There's two people I'm worried about right now.
Yeah.
Two people's sleep schedules, Zohran Mamdani and Kanita Hunter. What have you been up to?
Safira. So, I sleep.
You do?
I do sleep.
Okay.
Because I'm not functional when I don't sleep.
Okay, got it.
But have you heard of the Chinese thing 996?
No.
It's like it's a hustle culture phrase.
Okay.
That's like famous in the Chinese startup world.
Okay.
Where you work 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 6 days a week.
Yo.
Right?
Yo.
My time is not 9 a.m. because 9 a.m. is my lunch break.
Okay.
So I start with meetings. I start with my day at 7, so I'm ready for the day at 7. I've always been that person, though.
Yes.
I've always been in.
I remember back in the day.
Yeah, when you knew me, I was what? That was 2011. I was at Channel Islam at before
doing
6.
The first news, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So that has always been my thing.
Okay.
And then I have a hard 8 p.m. stop.
Okay.
Because I sleep early, and so I need that little lag time of. But the problem with
micro naps.
Yeah, but the problem is, a lot of my work is front facing. So when you're at events, if the aunties want to talk, the aunties want to talk.
Yes.
So I try not to mess around with the late nights. On the odd occasion, I do, but when I say it's a 7 to 8, it's a 7 to 8 run. And, you know, breaks for cella, breaks for toilet. Also, you know, I'm that one of those people that will only go to toilet when my ears are screaming.
Yes. Yo. So that's your day for now.
It kind of always has been.
Yeah. But doing your own thing, being with the debrief, does that mean there's no like 9 to 5? You don't end off at a specific time.
Yes. Again, not unusual for my life.
Yes.
What's unusual is that a lot of the time is front facing.
Okay.
Whereas before, it was deep analytical work, sitting and writing behind, like
chilling.
a lot of deep work by myself.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's teams and people and meeting and pitches and events. And so there's very little time for what I call real work.
Okay.
And that is what I don't like about me. So I don't know. So what I've been obsessed with now is when I meet people whose output I appreciate.
Yes.
So not all successful people.
Of course.
Like there's a certain type, and I often ask, like, these are like bankers and like interesting people who it's not a foreign concept working hard, and it's not their flex, right? I don't like to flex. I'm like, oh, I'm constantly busy. I hate that, right? You work or you don't work. That's your business, right? But I'm trying to find one, how to like human in a world where I cannot be busy. Right? So it can't be all or nothing. So I know how when I'm not working, I can like go to the gym and I can take a walk and I can da, da, da. But I'm like, is there a world that can coexist?
Is there?
I think so. I think so. So what I do, like, I have this frame of reference when it comes to Dean, right?
Okay, yeah.
It's called like a minimum framework.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
So there's like, you have to do these things, whether the sky is blue or black or yellow.
Of course. It's a lies on the top of it.
Yeah. Right? So like in the morning, like you, like that askar, whether like, if too bad you're late for the meeting.
It right?
And it took me years to get to that point of like, really? What's that minimum framework of like, you can't mess around with this.
Yes.
You know? And then it kind of worked a little bit to some degree in terms of like, now I'm on that kick when it comes to sleep.
Okay.
Because sleep hygiene, if you want to see the worst version of me, see a sleep deprived version of me.
Same.
And it's not cute.
Yeah. Same.
So now I'm trying to get it into like other fun areas, which is like the movement, the socializing, the life building.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm being a bit more deliberate in seeing how other people. Oh, and you know what's the other thing I'm obsessed about?
Yeah.
Is how not to get to zero.
Oof. In November 2025, that's a hard one.
You hear me? Like,
yeah.
I just. Yeah. I don't know
in
how,
order to pivot to do something only when you get to zero.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that nothing is a success unless you like burn yourself out.
We glorify burnout, yeah.
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 So I'm like, surely there must be a good medium range that we can stay safe in. But then you hear people to say that like, if you're really passionate about something, that world doesn't exist. I don't know. I'm trying. I don't know about you. What like,
it's difficult.
Are you all or nothing?
I am, but I'm really, as I said, the kick right now is prioritizing health because we only, for me personally, I only take it seriously when I'm at zero. Then it's like, oh, shit, need to do something, need to sort this out, need to.
But is there a world where it's not one thing? Because I know how to do that.
Yeah.
I know how to get to zero and be like, oh, okay, my spirituality is to the dogs, right? Yeah. Let's rebuild.
Yes.
My health is, you know, right, let's rebuild. I don't know how to keep these like stream, all roads, all like the whole highway open and just kind of go at a medium. That's the heart.
Something has to always give. Something has to always.
You know, Shonda Rhimes talks about that.
Yeah.
She says, she's a very well-known writer and TV producer. Yeah. And she says, when I'm succeeding in one area in my life, I'm almost certainly failing in another area.
Mm.
And I think it's your generation
who
came up with this toxic thing of like, you can be it all. I don't think you can. Yeah, why do you want to be all? Like,
yeah.
I don't know.
But I hear you on the spirituality. It took Hajj for me to realize that it's not by the way, your adhkar, your salah, it's not by the way. It's the first priority. That has to be the first priority.
Yeah.
If that is in order, everything else falls into place.
And it's not. So let me tell you how I looked at it, right?
Yeah.
It's like, surely you're going to miss salah if you don't have a burqa in your car.
Yes.
Done.
Yes.
Surely, and then the burqa in your car is not going to help you when you're not at your car.
Mm.
So you have to have the foldable musalla in your handbag.
Yes.
You understand?
Yeah.
Like if you're not enabled at every step of the way for every eventuality, like totsins, it's not going to work.
Finish. Khalas.
and that for me is like how I've planned my career in the sense of like, you, like it's important to you. So it has,
you've got to
You plug and play. You're ready at any time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think when it came to spirituality, it was, and spirituality, I find it very different from like aspects of Deen. Because aspects of Deen is like, that's a non-negotiable. Mm-hmm. Like those are like, it's not cute, you know, things.
It's not aesthetic. You're a guy who can wake you up for Fajr. You're supposed to be waking yourself up for Fajr.
Exactly.
What even?
Oh my God, I'm just seeing those memes of like, but what, like, So there's a, there's like a, that's what I say, a minimum baseline.
Yes.
And then there's the nice to have. Mm. So, so the minimum baseline is like, how is your life engineered for that? Mm. As you do it on health, as you do it on, with my career, as you do it in terms of my duty, as you do it as a friend.
Yeah.
Because you can be a terrible friend sometimes, yeah. you know? And so it's like, what is my minimum baseline in terms of like,
what's your non-negotiables when it comes to Dean?
Mine.
Yeah.
I think that, okay, I'm not going to say Salah on time because I still struggle with the on time bit.
Okay.
But like Salah, I'm much more strict with my morning than my evening because my evenings, I'm like,
yeah,
don't know where I am.
Yeah.
But my morning start is very important with me, to me. I think the morning adhkar is like non-negotiable. My wirdul latif in the morning, which is essentially a morning and evening duas, like that, like don't play with that. There are certain things you don't play with.
Yeah.
And then you don't like I'm obviously a student of Hifz, so like there's a certain amount of Quran that has to be read.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's not read when I'm traveling. Sometimes it's listened to.
Okay.
But there's a non-negotiable, like I'm very strict with myself when it comes to Quran, because Quran and the adhkar, like I have a very low baseline. I can't do the 10,000 astaghfirullah, right? So I have a very low baseline.
Trying.
Yeah, no, and that's exactly why you need to have that counter with you. But for me, it's like, because I subscribe to a certain zikr orientation, there's a certain prescription that I have to follow, right? Mm-hmm. But what I found is that the incentive for me is not a hereafter incentive.
Mm-hmm.
Reading Salah on time is all a selfish incentive of like, my day is better for it. I'm more regulated for it. Like, it's all dunya things. Yes. It's not like this massive, like, oh, I'm going to have a tree planted for me in Jannah. I'm not one of those people that can be incentivized by that.
Yes, yes.
So for me, that waking up early, prioritizing Fajr, prioritizing Quran, prioritizing the zikr, and having and being consistent with it, and then adding the morning pages of like writing to it is like a selfish endeavor to say, like, otherwise I'm helter skelter for the day.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to have the output that I have, someone said it to me last year, old uncle, he said, if you are in any position where people feed off your energy, how are you replenishing your energy?
Mm.
And we often replenish our energy in the worst ways, because if some people are sucking from you, how are you?
Especially being out there.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's like, as Muslims, we have that added layer of galvanizing, if you like.
Mm.
And that, for me, was when it clicked for me of like, oh, this is not separate to my job or separate to my life or separate to, it's actually, we're on a journey that's bigger than ourselves.
Yeah.
And these are all tools that stay, like, it's the engine and it's the indicators and it's every component
works together.
Book works together.
Hmm. So how's the launch been?
Of the book?
Yes.
Safira, it's been scarier, hey?
Why?
You see, when you put your brains out,
yes,
hate it or like it, I don't care.
Yeah.
It's my analysis.
Yes.
It's my reporting. It's my investigation.
Yes.
Fine.
Yeah.
Hate it or like it. When you put your heart out, harder one.
Yeah. I only get that because I did it.
It's
a vulnerable moment.
It's a vulnerable moment because it's art. It's part of you. It's your, it's a story that you've comes from your vulnerabilities, comes from your fears, your life experiences. So even though it's fiction, it's still a part of you in so many ways. Why am I like this is also harder for me because it's kind of the fruit of a very painful unraveling, my own painful unraveling.
Really?
And my own journey that kind of, the book was just the fruit of it. Alhamdulillah, something positive came out of it. But it really came in a time of my life which was not very pretty and was exceptionally messy.
Really?
Yeah.
And that's how you wrote the book.
So let me tell you how I wrote the book.
Yes. I want to hear.
You remember I did Gucci Girl when I was 19.
Yeah.
Right. I was embarrassed of Gucci Girl.
Why?
I didn't give Gucci Girl the recognition of what it meant for culture and what it meant to Muslim women and what it meant as a 19-year-old to publish a book and for the book to do better than some of my political books did.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
I was so hell-bent on this vision of like, I'm going to be a serious political journalist and I'm not going to be writing fun stories for, how am I going to make a living of like making Indian aunties feel better about themselves, or, yeah, you know, like, and I was so stoic about it. And I had these like mad goals of like, and I don't know why I thought that there was like a, I don't know if I thought I was going to die at 30. I think I was going to die at 30. But it was like, I need to do this. I need to become an editor. I need to write this book.
I remember you in that era.
Yeah.
Very driven.
Driven like a mad person. Yes. Right?
Ambitious and driven.
And then, That list gets ticked off.
Of course.
Right? You're the first this, you're the first that, you're this award, that award, that award, that award. And what's left of you is depletion. Right?
Mm.
And I say that like, the 5 years of ultimate success in my career was the 5 worst years of my life.
Really?
I lost my mother. I lost my father. I lost a child. I got divorced. And then like cherry on top, I lost all my savings. Like just to seal the deal.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
These are not like small life. Mm. I'm not talking about the small issues that happen in between. Mm. These are from the outside. These are massive
things. It takes people like a whole lifetime to lose so much. Mm. And you lose it all in 5 years.
Yeah. And then more than that is this compulsion or this, I don't know this instinct to say, I can't be defined by the bad that's happening to me because there's so much of good that's happening to me.
Mm.
But then it creates a dilemma because are you gaslighting yourself, right?
Mm.
Because now the whole world thinks your life's perfect. Mm-hmm. Now you're on a plane. Now you're here. Now you're there. Now you're in this Paris. Now you're in this restaurant. Now you're in you're speaking to this world leader. It seems amazing.
Mm.
And it is amazing because... Mm. Those are incredible, incredible life opportunities.
Of course.
Right? But then there's also this like really terrible thing that happens. Right? And the mad thing about my life is that it always comes together. The good and the bad comes same time.
So interesting.
If I say it out loud.
The ease and the difficulty together.
Straight away. So for me, there was always the sense of like, if I am succumbing to the grief of the moment, I'm being ungrateful for the blessings that are... No one wants to be the girl with the dead mother.
Mm.
You don't want your... Like, how do you deal with this, right? You get promoted and divorced in the same week.
Yo.
Those are extremes.
Yes. Yeah.
Right?
Big extremes.
Big extremes. But then, like, now, if you let your grief walk in the room, she just got divorced. It's, if that becomes your story, that's a betrayal to the ni'mas that Allah has given you.
Oh, yeah. I hear you.
Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Like, how can
I... So what you did was you kept suppressing.
I kept suppressing because I'm like, I can't give in.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so much of good. And so... So yeah, maybe I've not been so lucky in some areas of my life, but gosh, Allah has given me enormous amounts of blessings in other areas of my life. And I'm not even saying it in a facetious way. Mm. I genuinely, like some of the things that some of the opportunities, some of the way my life has panned out was not meant to be the story of the girl you met who came from Desert Wales on a bus to Channel Islam. Like it's mad.
Yeah.
You understand what I'm saying? And so I had to like owe it to the ni'mas or the blessings that come my way to say, no, I'm gonna make the most of it.
Yes.
But it does create it like whiplash.
Because we're also in this culture of toxic positivity. Be grateful. Mad, be grateful.
Mad.
Be grateful.
I was the queen of toxic positivity. I am a queen of toxic positivity.
I could share the crown with you. I think I could.
Because essentially, I always looked at it like this. Okay, now I'm gonna... Okay, fine. My mother's dead. Now what?
Mm-hmm.
But then, what I've subsequently learned is that you have to feel the feelings.
Really?
Because if you keep it moving, one day one day you'll just crash. You will crash. So
when did that happen?
There's no medal at the end of the day. So I think for me, I've had bouts of crashes, but the crash happened last year when I was just like, I'm done. This job is not worth it. It's absolutely not worth it. Keeping it moving for what? And I had to do the radical, because I, like I said, I'm an all or nothing person, right? Yeah. So I had to quit my job, move out of my house, sell my car. Like I had to go to zero. I had to do the equivalent of, you know, when the IT, those irritating IT people tell you, did you switch off your computer and restart? Yeah. That's what I had to do. And that burnout was so extreme and so messy. And it came long after the grief, which is weird, right? Because you think that the crash happens at the time you lost your mother, and it doesn't happen. It doesn't come then. It comes long after the fact. And then you like, as someone whose worth was so much tied to being busy, it was like, now what? Who am I? Cause now remember, your phone's not ringing with, like, there's some thrill that comes with, this politician's looking for you and this meeting and you back to back, and it justifies the brokenness you feel on the inside. But now when that all stops, now you have to deal with yourself, eh? And it's mad and messy. And when I tell you that it took me to Tarim and to Turkey and to, it just, like, honestly, I think I've said this 100 times now, but I'm going to say it again. Like, the last year, it felt like if you had to cut me open, you'd only find grief in me. I felt like all I was carrying was just like
pain and grief.
Pain and grief. And I had no reason to. I had no reason at that point in my life.
It was all the grief that you suppressed over all the years.
Yeah.
You stopped being busy and now it's pouring out of you.
That's it. That's exactly it.
So you decide to write a really cool book.
I mean, I think
it, overachiever much.
I think it had, the book had to come from a point of silence. So I had to sit on an island by myself with no electricity and only donkeys.
Okay.
For this to come to life. Cause I think great pieces of art only come when there's a sense of, reckoning with yourself. So I think it had to come in that way. But also it was the culmination of like some of the thoughts that I was having, some of the vulnerability, some of the, like, I didn't know how to house a dramatic weight loss journey, right? And I didn't have the words for it for 5-6 years. It was just something that I just kept it moving.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
I didn't know how to deal with the construct of loneliness when I'm like surrounded with, like, by, I have like the most amazing people in my life, yet I've constantly had this ache of loneliness, right? So those vulnerabilities are things that you like, you don't really know how to deal with it until you deal with it. And it's messy.
It's messy. It's not easy.
Yeah.
So where are you now emotionally?
I think that
I was it cathartic writing the book and sharing the book and launching the book?
Immensely, because I would have never had this conversation with anyone a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
I speak a lot, but think about how much I actually share.
Yeah, you're quite private.
Like, it's, I'm not one of those people that are like, you know everything about me, but you know nothing about me.
Yeah.
And it's simply because I made an active choice that my work persona is my persona, but there's obviously life that happens in between, right? And I think there's a sense of freedom that comes, which has been like, okay, so I was a mess up. Like, you know, like, oh, it didn't go according to plan. You know, there's that freedom that comes with it. Alhamdulillah. And I also think that I'm in a different phase of my life. I have nothing to prove. Like me or don't like me. Give me the job or don't give me the job. You know?
Yeah.
Versus this like chase that was happening. I think that there's nothing more freeing than confronting your vulnerabilities.
I have an interesting question to your previous point where you said, when you experiencing all these wonderful things in life and concurrently you having also these challenges, this grief and all these painful moments, you feel you have to concentrate on the ni'mah. How much of that do you think is rooted in the fact where you grow up in humble beginnings and you never thought that this would be your life, and now you've achieved all of this. You've gotten all of this. You've gotten all of this recognition. So you feel like you owe it to yourself to be grateful, even though you're breaking apart.
100% it comes from that, because I say this often. I'm like, I come from Reservoir Hills. The best case scenario for me was that, like, not the best case. I like what I envisioned was that I would like maybe get a job at the Pick and Pay or the, or like the Mr. Price, and then I'll teach me. I'm in no way making teaching madrasa small, but I'm saying to you that like when you come from, we call it humble beginnings, we call it poverty, you call it whatever it may be, it's like anything is better than yesterday, right? Let me tell you, it's a superpower, because you have nothing to lose, because you've lost, you come from nothing, right? Yeah. So that's the superpower that made me successful.
Really?
Because I can try it. If it doesn't work,
it doesn't work.
Like, I can apply for the job. If I don't get that job and I get any job, cool.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. As long as it's a job.
So there was a sense of like
fearlessness
that it empowered me, right?
Yes.
But then it was like, it's like, let me give you an example. For 10 years of my life, I would never order a drink in a restaurant.
Yeah.
Because like,
order the water.
Order the free water.
Get the tap water.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because first of all, it's mind-blowing that I can sit in a restaurant and order. That's not, it's not natural to me.
Mm-hmm.
To the point now where I'm like, right now, my kitchen is being, I don't have a kitchen at the moment. So four meals a day, I buy out. Relish sees me more than anyone in my family sees me. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
It's not something that I can ever, it's never ever lost on me. Yeah. And that's why, like, the wildness of my life is, let me give an example. Last year, I'm in Cape Town. My cousin at the time, he has this house in Bantry Bay, which is incredible.
Really?
He sold the house. Oh, but anyways. Hey, listen, I'm in Cape Town. I don't have accommodation. Can I stay at your place? No, no problem. Cause he rents it out and so free of charge. Probably the best views in Cape Town. 2 weeks of absolute luxury, right? I come back to Joburg, I leave for Tarim. 2 weeks of 50-degree weather, shared bathroom, sleeping on the floor, no sleep.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so there's a very big part of my life that's super comfortable with discomfort, right?
Okay.
Because like
upbringing.
It comes or it goes.
Yeah.
So there's never a time where I'm like, okay, maybe now like I'm lying to myself and I'm like, oh, like I'm not bougie. I am a little bit bougie. Like, give me nice sheets. But like, there's, you know that ayat, watilkal ayyamu nadawilu habayna nas. You embody it to say like, you're not going to rain forever. It's not going to be sunny forever. If you believe it's not going to rain forever, you also have to know that it's not going to be sunny forever. And I think I have. That's why, like, rolling with the punches, like, I can do that, you know? But there's some days where you have to see, like, it's flooding.
What do you do on those days?
What do you do on those days?
What do you do?
Who, me now?
Yeah.
I cry in a corner.
Warning pages.
I write a fictional novel whose problems are bigger than mine.
Love the book. I finished it in 2 hours.
Tell me.
I started reading it. So I kept it aside because I didn't want to read it. Initially, I was like, okay, I'm going to get it closer to the podcast. And then, you know, the inner reader in me just grabbed the book at about 5. My granny-in-law was sitting watching Pakistani dramas. I was sitting and reading, couldn't put it down. I liked it. I really, really liked the story. I love the character of Farah, but I loved the character of Comrade Z. How did you make these characters?
So
how did you conceptualize them?
The book was conceptualized through the story of the mother.
Really?
I didn't think of the daughter. I thought the story that was more important for me was the mother's story, because I was grappling with fears of the emptiness after a big life.
Okay, yes.
This big, impactful life that's actually very lonely and sad.
Okay.
And that's the vulnerabilities that I was kind of, and so I conceptualized this character, and then in sitting down and writing the story, it made more sense and more contemporary to tell the story of this daughter who, for me, is like this
antithesis of you.
The antithesis of me, essentially. A nepo baby. I'm like, damn it. People are like, is this your story? I'm like, I want to be a 27-year-old who's finding herself on her mother's dime. But I mean, jokes. But so then I knew kind of not the themes that I wanted to, like I want to discuss grief. It wasn't like that, but it was like, I have something to say around constructs of grief, around constructs about body and image and weight, around constructs of unrequited love, around the messiness of finding yourself. And then the characters kind of just came to life in that way.
Okay.
And so I love that you said that you were more precious, or the character of the mother spoke to you more, because love that was actually the story that I wanted to tell.
Okay.
Farah's story was like what enabled me to tell that bigger story.
Okay.
It
was a beautiful, it was a beautifully written character. Comrade C was.
Yo. It's hard. Wow. Because you see, it's easy to write heroes, right? It's easy to write people who've done things, but to write a hero who is at the fragility of life and is just like, it's the end now. And
at the mercy of a mind that made you achieve so much.
Yeah.
That was poignant.
And that for me, now I'm going to start crying, but can we cry?
Yes, we can.
But like, for me, there was two parts of it that inspired that journey. The one was like my father's story, right? And like this man who had like, I don't talk about it, but okay, can we go back to talking fun stuff? But like how somebody can just live such a full life and then succumb to vulnerability of the vulnerability of your mind letting you down, which would be no different to someone who becomes paralyzed or, but the idea of like, exploring the theme of dementia was important to me to make sense of the helplessness of seeing a parent become a child. And you have to be the caregiver for a parent. So that was the thinking in that way, right? And then I think the other part of it is my own fears of living a strong, big, large life, but when it matters the most, it's alone and lonely and sad. And so trying to navigate between the two. And I don't think she had a lonely end. I think she had the end that she needed to have.
Yeah.
But that kind of was the vulnerability that I had to contend with in creating that character.
It's a beautifully written character. And then the grief was that cathartic to write.
I think.
Because for me, that was very poignant. That chapter really hit.
The loss of the mother.
The loss of the mother.
I think that for anyone who's lost a parent, it's like, so losing anybody means different things to how that person showed up in your life.
Yeah.
But just in principle, losing a parent is like losing a limb.
Really?
It never stops hurting. It never, ever, ever stops hurting. And I think that what I was very intentional about was that I didn't make the grieving process
pretty
because also, I don't want to give away too much, but like,
yeah, don't.
It was, the relationship was a different relationship because in some degree, I also felt like that was a way to explore my relationship with my mother, because when I lost my mother, I didn't lose a mother. I lost like my person in life, which is a very different grieving, because what I imagine losing a mother to be, like a mother figure, is that like, who's going to do this for me? And who's like, the grief was like, I'm living this big, big, big life because of the sacrifices this woman made for me. Right? And I'm sharing in the full madness of this life with this person who's cheering me on at every, and then this person just is not there anymore. And it hits you like, I launched my book on Tuesday night. When I got home, I mean, my mother, I've lost my mother more than 7 years now, right? I instinctively picked up my phone to phone Mrs. Hunter to share, like, cause who's gonna actually selflessly share in the joy of your achievements than a parent or than that figure in your life, you know? And it's not about the, like, it's not about the it's not about, like, oh, the Eids and the emptiness. Like, that's easy. You get used to that type of stuff. What you don't get used to, it's like you re-grieve every time something big happens in your life.
It just comes back.
You have to re-mourn at every big milestone in your life. You have to re-mourn the loss of that parent. So it's like you lose your parent. And then something amazing happens and you write a bestseller and they're not there to witness that. And your life becomes infinitely better over the years and they're not there to witness that. But then you go through a divorce and there's no mother to call. And so at every milestone that happens, good and bad, it's a re-grieving that happens. And so for someone who's like, keep it moving is my energy.
Yeah.
It's very destabilizing because it's like, it never, you just kind of learn to live with it. And I understand why people lose 10, 20 years of their life in grief. I understand it now, you know. At the time, I used to be pompous about it, to be like, you have a say in how you show up. And I'm like, no, I understand it. I really, really do.
Is there a way to prepare yourself?
I don't think so. And I don't think there's like the superpower to out. And I think maybe that's what got me in the hole that I was in, was that you kind of create a sense of invincibility about yourself. It's pompous. Mm-hmm. It's arrogant to be like, I'm not going to let my life stop because I just went through something difficult. I'm going to go back to work and I'm going to go bigger and badder. And then life will humble you. It will. And I think that, for me, the lesson is that Allah wants to teach you is that this, you're not invincible, my girl. Like, you're not.
Yeah.
And you have to succumb to it.
Yeah.
Because that's the test of life, right? Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. You have to internalize it and you have to feel the pain, you know? And there's no cheating your way out of it.
Yeah.
And again, like I said, there's no middle at the end of the day for like being super functional, even though you're in the depths of despair.
The Barzakh series was cool by Umar Suleiman. They're cheering you on. They're really cheering you on.
Inshallah.
Ameen. I love the mental health bit. I also don't want to give too much away, but how much did you draw from your own experience as a mental health advocate, especially in the media spaces?
Yeah.
And then touching on the mental health aspect of the book.
So it's, I don't know if it's my DNA or what it is, right? But I'm just like a person that will never keep, like, I was trying to explain to my team the other day. No is something I don't hear. There's no like, you can't tell me, there has to be a way.
So you can't tell you can't do it?
No.
Okay.
If you want me to do it, tell me.
Somebody very close in my life is exactly like that.
If you want me to do it, tell me you can't do it, right?
Yeah.
But I'm saying, when I got to that point of like, I'm sick of myself, I'm like, right, I cannot be here. There's no thing of like, oh, defeat. Like,
yeah. So nobody can tell you no.
No one can tell me no. And so the thing that I did to my mental health is what I know how to do, right? Which is create a plan of action and don't stop until it's done.
Okay.
Right? I did that with my health. I did that with my career. I did that with everything. So this was me going from therapist to therapist. It was me going from therapy to therapy. It was, I will try everything I possibly can because there's no way I can accept this to be my norm. Right?
Okay.
And it sends you down a course of meeting the most mad and crazy and like, I can't tell you how many chakras I've encountered in this journey and how much of energy and wild things, right? So if you were to ask me like what worked,
yeah.
I don't know if a particular thing worked. Mm. I don't know if it was the psychologist X or psychiatrist Y or TRE or this or that or that or that. What I do know is that if it was any other area of life, seeking assistance would not be an anomaly.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no anomaly in trying to get the help.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Then what does that help look like? I think it's different for different phases of your life. I think there was a time in my life where talk therapy was very important.
Yeah.
I don't think this phase of my life talk therapy is important.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a time in my life where you know, going to a psychiatrist was important to deal with burnout and to find the person. I mean, I found a wonderful doctor who actually super specializes in high performing women. That's her area of
drop the deets.
But like, what I'm saying to you is that again, there's no part of me that discounts the fact that it's a huge blessing to be able to have the opportunity to seek the help that I have.
Okay.
Right? So I wanted to have fun with it, also to poke fun at myself. Like, come on, you know, I'm a huge, huge proponent of journaling.
Yes.
And I'll tell you why I am.
Mm.
It's because there are certain things that I've realized that are privileges that you cannot go and punt to women who are in abusive situations to go for talk therapy. Who's going to pay for it? Who's going to pay 1,200 rand?
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So you have to have a sensitivity about what it is that people, that realities of life, right?
Mm.
But there are certain things that you have to understand, it like how we have now come a long way to be like, you have to move your body for 10,000 steps a day. Like that's, you know what I mean? Like
there's
certain levels of preemptive wellness that you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise you're going to end up depressed.
Yeah.
So it's more of like shifting the conversation from being in the hole to say, how do I not get into the hole? And there are certain easy things. Like, you know, when we spoke about sleep, for example, sleep hygiene. I'm evangelical about it because I understood what days and days and days of not sleeping did to me and what it like did to my anxiety levels. Right. Things like why journaling every morning is important, because there's some science around that morning pages of dumping your thoughts onto paper, almost like a mental excretion, right? I am now deep down a rabbit hole of the physical manifestation of trauma, which understands why I'd suffered with morbid obesity my whole life, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in understanding it and doing the research around it, prompts actions around, okay, there are therapies, there are new innovations that understand or guide you to a point that like, no, you can't treat weight loss when you're morbidly obese as an eating thing. This is a mental thing. It's a disease you're fighting.
Yes.
It's not a self control. You can't control your way out of this.
No ways.
So that's, I had all of these experiences, these conversations, this research, and I thought, let's have fun with it. And I don't know if it landed well. What do you think?
I felt seen with the character not being stick thin. I like the therapy aspect also, and I like the fact that you documented the journey. It's not, yes, now you're going to have this, all these struggles and a cute little montage and then it's over. So I like that bit. I particularly like the fact that you mentioned the struggle of weight in the main character of the book.
Yeah. And I think the one thing that I wanted to verbalize was something that I had to contend with, which was thinking that once you lose the weight, like all the problems are solved. And the fact that you actually feel worse about yourself and the way people treat you after you lose weight than better about yourself.
Seriously.
You feel terrible.
Why?
Because you would, like, if you were mean to me, be mean to me with your chest.
Yeah.
Like, don't like my person. Like, you were that fickle. Because I was 150 kilos, you could have treated me badly. And now that I'm, like, half my weight.
So people treat you differently.
100%.
Oh.
I earn more because I'm thin.
Yo.
We live in a fickle world.
Damn.
I'm not saying this, the research backs it up.
Yeah.
Let me give you an
example. And we're going towards that as a society again. There was the body positivity
movement. Which I think was toxic, because it normalized for yes. all of us,
yes.
it'll help.
It'll help, definitely.
It no, because yeah. think about it.
Yeah.
Me and you have never had confidence problems.
No.
We've never not. Ever had
because the face card doesn't decline.
Because the face card does da da da, right? Also, like, come here, my personality will out-personality you.
100%.
But somebody who loved us should tap us and say, my lovey, you're killing yourself.
Yes.
Because if we had a drug habit, somebody would have had to do yes. that intervention.
Yes.
You get my point?
I do.
And so I think there's... And let me tell you, I don't talk about weight loss because we still come from that toxic era of like silver bullet or and at orientation that it's like it's a self-control thing.
Yeah.
I'm like, you think you... Especially like, I just need to eat healthy and I lose the weight. No. I'm like, you think you're that strong? You think your mind is that strong? I'm like, this is a hard journey. And it's toxic to be like, oh, what did you do? I'm like, I did everything. What did you, I literally lost your body weight in weight. Yeah. You think one shake helped me?
No.
Do you get my point?
I do. I get you. I'm in the middle of it. I get it.
It's weird. And you know what? You know, what's the worst thing? Then you summit the mountain, nah? And then you realize the way down is harder than the way up.
No.
It's harder. Because remember, now you have to sustain it. There's no like, mama, I made it. And then we enjoy it here.
And I'm sure the fear is always there.
The fear is always there.
Yo.
It's when I say I changed the way I think about addiction when I confronted my weight loss journey, I mean it.
Really?
Because I'm like, I understand it. I get it. It is hard.
Another beautiful, we're going away from the weight. Another very beautiful and powerful theme in the book was the power of female friendships.
Mm-hmm.
Can we touch a little bit on that?
Yeah, I think that has been the gift of my life. Like to have a solid community.
Yeah, the village.
The village. And even though I say like, I contend with this thing of like constantly feeling lonely and like or constantly feeling like an outsider in every space. I don't think we come to realize what our parents did to have the villages they had. And I think that taking the character on that journey of like feeling like you have nobody to then realizing that you have to show up in the village.
Inconvenience is the price we pay for community.
Girl. Right?
This is turning into a therapy session. Let me tell you something.
You know, my mother used to, like, I will go to Masjid al-Aqsa.
Yeah.
And there'll be an auntie that meets me there, right? Yeah. And be like, you know, your mother used to made the banana puri for my son's wedding. And this auntie, what was she busy? What business? And I'm saying that generation knew how to show up in a way. Maybe they took it to two extremes.
Yeah.
It was very self-sacrificing. Mm-hmm. But the point is, they had communities because they were prepared to be inconvenienced for it.
Mm.
And I didn't know what that looked like on a in a nuclear urban living
situation.
You know, where we like, you know,
because it's easier to have this village in Reservoir Hills, Klerksdorp, the small towns. But in Joburg, you've got to really
you have to be deliberate about
it. Yeah, you have to.
You have to be deliberate about it, and you have to. It takes. It's not. I hate to say this, but actually, some people are not. Some people join the village for the tea and not to be villagers.
Yes, true facts. Did your village bring you through this, that 5 year, the difficulty, the pain, the emotions?
I think that
when you were bleeding grief.
Yes. And think about like what my village has always been. It's Safira giving me a lift when I had no car and wanted to be a journalist as an 18 year old. Right? I'm saying it's like this construct of like, I'm a self-made woman. No, you're not.
You're the sum of all the people around us.
All of the people, all of the energy, all of the, you know, the, like just the the kindness of someone, the kindness of people who have to say to me, my girl, like, go and get help.
Mm.
Some people don't have that.
Mm.
Some people don't have people who love them enough to say, hey,
wake up.
Wake up. Some people don't love them enough to say, like, girl, you are not praying. Like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
And I think that for me,
your village doesn't always agree with you. Let me tell you guys that.
Mm.
Sometimes they've got to be a bit harsh on you.
Yeah.
And for people like us, it brings you down to earth.
No, it brings you. It
they will humble you.
You.
They will humble you. Q, are we going to see more fiction?
I hope so.
I really hope so too.
I mean, I really would love to be able for this to be the only thing I do in life. But I have to earn an income. I don't have a trust fund yet.
Yet.
But inshallah.
It's a season of storytelling in our community. Brief advice to any authors out there who want to share their stories. What would you tell them?
To be a writer, you have to write. Write and write and write. And do not be married to your story. You are not special. You will edit it and edit it and edit it until you blue in the face, but write your story. There's no perfect story at first draft. There's never a perfect story at first draft. And I say that the only thing that sets me apart is not, I'm not a good writer. The only quality I have in life is discipline to see something through. So you have to do it and do it. Because think about it. Everybody has an amazing story. What makes you a writer? So you have the discipline to see the journey through.
Absolutely.
Anybody can put pen to paper.
Yes. You've got to put it out there.
Yeah.
You've got to put yourself out there.
And you've got to
just do it.
Do it.
I tell him, I say, just do it.
Yeah.
I always end off the Chai Lounge on rapid fire questions. So the segment is called, Why Am I Like This? What was your Why Am I Like This moment recently, Kanita Hunter?
When I was in Oman and I genuinely believed that I'm a minimalist. I always believe I'm a minimalist. I don't shop in my mind. I can survive with one overnight suitcase, and I bought 20 books, or I don't know how many books, at a book fair in Oman, and I had nowhere to put it. And I'm like, why am I like this? Why do I believe that I'm this minimalist? I found things to buy in Syria. Aleppo. I found coats to buy, and I had no bag, and I had to buy a bag to bring it home. I can't tell you how messy I am, because I just not confront the reality that actually I like dinger.
The next one, why am I like this? If you have to have a debrief session over coffee, because Farah likes coffee, who would you invite? Living, dead, famous, non-famous?
Apa Hunter.
She's going to bring us biscuits.
Mrs. Hunter will sip her rooibos and have her banana puri, and I'll judge her for it. And we'll have a full debrief.
Love it. Who would play Farah in Comrade Z if we have to reenact Why Am I Like This is a 2000s rom-com?
This is a cool one. So Farah will be, what's that girl's name from? We're talking celebrities.
Yeah, we're talking celebrities. Yeah, we're going big.
It's going to be a
huge rom-com with a big, big budget.
You know the girl who acted in what is her name? You see, I'm not very good at watching movies, but I know exactly who it is. Ask me the question again. Let me think.
Okay.
Let's come back to that question.
Can we reenact Preeti Zinta and Shah Rukh Khan as Comrade Z and Uncle Momo? Just asking. Anyway, next question. Farah's most frequently used emoji.
Farah's most frequently used emoji is monkey eyes. Eyes, covering eyes.
Such a millennial. Why am I like this? What shocked Farah the most about being thin?
That people are kinder to you when you are thin. For no other reason.
Who is Comrade Z's favorite politician?
I think she is a Joel Nishitense Thabo Mbeki Polokwane Mona type.
The question, why am I like this? Would Farah launch a podcast? And what would it be called?
She's very annoying, and she will. And it will be called something like Farah's Corner.
Can you advise our good sisters in situationships right now? Do you respond to the text, yes or no?
Girl, I'm going to say it once. Hear me. And I'm never saying it again. It never ends well.
So no to responding to the text.
Don't go there.
Don't go there. Girls, you heard it first here. Our next podcast is going to be a relationship podcast.
Please not from me.
Kanita, I need to ask you this. What is Farah doing for money in Cyril's economy?
She's living off her mother who worked damn hard. Terrible. And now she's like, you know those girls who work for as a hobby and they don't work for rent?
Yeah.
She annoys the crap out of me for that reason. You know those girls?
Yes, I do.
Work is a hobby, Moss.
She's sitting in Mila's cafe as we speak right now. Yes.
You went there?
I went there. Is she swapping? Speaking of Mila, is she swapping her coffee for matcha? Yes or no?
Yeah, she's impressionable like that. I had the worst matcha yesterday of my life. I'm not going to name and shame the place. But, you know, when they say it's grass, it was grass. Oh, anyways, back to coffee today.
So you're launching merch with the book.
Yes.
Alhamdulillah. What would Comrade Z's merch tote read?
That's a nice question. It would read, "Get up, girlfriend."
I like that one. So if Farah had to get married, we're not giving anything away.
Yeah.
What millennial aesthetic will be at the wedding? Are we talking the cheesy photo booth?
That's a nice question. I'm thinking like macaron era.
Oh, 2014's Pinterest.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm thinking like,
we created you in pairs. Little pairs on the table.
Yes.
There we go. What's Layla's signature scent?
Rich.
What is she wearing with those fancy pajamas of hers?
What is that brand? Only the girls who get it. Byredo.
Byredo.
Yeah. Yeah.
So she shops at Skins 100%.
Yeah. That's the energy.
Laughing.
This is not Elizabeth Ardenia.
No. We're not doing.
This is not DKNY.
Plaza perfumes. No. Thank you for joining me on the show. It was really lovely chatting to you.
Why you made me cry? Now I was like,
I swear, from the time we started, there's not a guest who hasn't cried. The Chai Lounge. It's a therapy session, yeah.
You know what it is, though? Because I think you're an amazing interviewer. And I think that...
Thank you. It means a lot coming from you.
No, I really mean it. But I also think that it's you give people space to think and speak. And so it's not rushed, rehearsed. And so you can't bullshit your way. I don't know if I can say that word. But you can't keep up a facade when it's quiet and silent and long. And I think it those are the podcasts that make impact when people are authentic. So well done.
Thank you. Where's the book available?
The book is available at all bookstores, but you can get signed copies from my website, manitahunter.com. You can get signed copies there. And it's available at all leading bookstores. I've been loving the feedback, so I want to hear people's feedback. Before, like normally I don't like to read reviews and don't give me feedback on 8 days in July and whatever. Here, I really want to hear what people think about the characters.
Okay. So they can tag you on Instagram if they
need to. Yes, that would be nice.
That would be really nice. It was lovely chatting to you. Thank you for this. I enjoyed every second of our interview together. And I hope you guys continue listening to the Chai Lounge podcast. You can leave all your questions and comments on our Instagram page. From myself, Safira, as well as Kanita Hunter, it's Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.